Hello, listeners. Welcome to Politico's Nerdcast. I'm your host, Scott Bland. Thanks for tuning in. This week on the Nerdcast, we will discuss the top takeaways from the first big multi-state primary night in 2018. We previewed that for you last week, and we are going to talk through some of the results. Plus, we're going to get into what to watch in the next round of primaries coming up on May 15th. We've got races coming up in Pennsylvania, Nebraska, and a few other states that night. Then, in our second segment, we are going to dissect one of President Trump's biggest foreign policy weeks on the job. He scrapped the Iran deal, and in North Korea, three American detainees have been released just as the summit with Kim Jong-un nears. So we're going to talk a little bit through about what this all means and how these strategies are diverging and yet intertwined all at the same time. A reminder to you, our Nerdcast listeners, to subscribe, rate us, and write a review. And stay tuned for the end of the show for a contribution from one of the Nerdcast's biggest fans. One more note before we begin, we're taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, May 10th, so it's all up to date as of then. This is especially dangerous when we do foreign policy segments. I want to welcome our guests for our first segment, Charlie Mattesian, senior politics editor and Nerdcast regular. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Scott.
And Steve Shepard, our chief polling analyst. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
All right, our first data point, 20%. That is how much of the vote former coal magnate Don Blankenship captured in Tuesday's West Virginia GOP Senate primary. Good enough for a third-place finish behind Congressman Evan Jenkins in second place and State Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, who will be the Republican nominee to take on Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, one of the hottest Senate races in the country in 2018. Steve, start us off here. I mean, the news was all about Blankenship in the last week of the race. There were rumors and reporting about internal polls that showed him surging despite the opposition of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and a lot of Republicans in Washington who thought that he would have been a disaster because of his role in a mining disaster that killed 29 people in 2010, for which he went to prison. And yet, Blankenship ended up finishing third. You know, what happened there?
Primaries are just, they're very different from general elections, where you can basically predict how somebody's going to vote based on their party identification. You don't have that in primaries. Primaries tend to be a lot more fluid. And what we saw happen in this case is last week, there was a debate. It was on Fox News Channel. A lot of people watched it in West Virginia. A lot of Republican primary voters watched it. And after that debate, if you talk to the two rival campaigns, both Congressman Evan Jenkins and State Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, they saw Don Blankenship rising in the polls after that, and they started to get worried. A lot of that reporting was from our colleague Alex Eisenstadt. You saw some of the polls from the Morrissey campaign and the Jenkins campaign end up on the Weekly Standards website. You heard Patrick Morrissey on Sunday, 2 days before the election, have a press conference all about Don Blankenship and all about why he was going to notify Don Blankenship, who this time last year was in a halfway house in Phoenix, Arizona, finishing his sentence for conspiring to skirt mine safety standards in an incident that led to 29 deaths. He talked about informing Don Blankenship's probation officer that Don Blankenship had not fulfilled his ethics requirements, disclosing his personal finances with the U.S. Senate, as all Senate candidates are required to do. That's what they were talking about 2 days before the election. And Patrick Morrissey was asked, and he said, "We have seen Don Blankenship rise in the polls. Ultimately, it looks like that late counteroffensive worked, and voters didn't choose him."
I know I have a reputation as being radical, and I've told people that you don't make fundamental change if you're not radical, according to Webster's Dictionary. So I feel very good about the effort we made, very bad about the fact that we failed West Virginians. Somehow we couldn't convince them.
Not just that, but President Donald Trump weighed in via tweet on Monday, as he is wont to do, imploring voters to choose someone else because Blankenship couldn't win, he said.
Yeah.
I think the upshot of all this is, like, it's not actually clear that these polls were wrong showing Blankenship on the rise, despite the fact, you know, there's been a lot of commentary afterwards with obviously the results turning out with him in third. But, you know, for all we know, it worked.
Yes.
What Morrissey and Jenkins were trying to do.
No, and I think the Trump tweet was the linchpin in that effort. That told people this, you know, I kind of like this guy's sticking a giant middle finger at the Washington establishment and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, whom I don't like. But you know what? This isn't the fight to have. Let's have the fight with Joe Manchin in November.
And Charlie, in so doing and consigning Blankenship to third place, it was a good night for Senate Republicans. They got a nominee who they're happy with in West Virginia. They got one that they're happy with in Indiana in businessman Mike Braun, who kind of split between two congressmen to get the nomination there. And of course, they've got Jim Renacci in Ohio, which is long expected to take on Sherrod Brown there. So it was a pretty good night for Senate Republicans as they look forward to contesting some of those red state Senate races in 2018.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty good night for the establishment in both parties overall, broadly speaking, over the four states on Tuesday. I know not everyone feels that way, but certainly I do. And I thought it was a very good night for Senate Republicans because they don't have to worry about one more freak show candidate, and that's what Blankenship would have been. He would have been in a long line of Republican freak show candidates, whether you're talking about Roy Moore or Todd Akin or Richard Murdoch, people that are just out there saying things, you know, jaw-dropping things that are not only dooming the chances of winning seats that should be lockdown victories, but also being used against the entirety of the party and every Senate candidate across the map. So, you know, not having to worry about Blankenship is a great thing for McConnell. And the same thing with Braun. I think Braun is probably the toughest challenger in a lot of ways that Donnelly could have gotten. But what I do think is notable is I don't think Marcy's that good. You know, I have that. We were joking before the show about the piece I wrote today, and a lot of the criticism I've gotten about it because people think that.
Well, what was the headline on that piece, Charlie?
The headline is Why the Democrats Just Lost the Senate. And so I wrote about the Blankenship issue and how that was a blow to Manchin, and I believe that. But at the same time, all of the people who are kicking my butt on Twitter right now and writing angry emails and clogging up my email box think that I was somehow writing that Morrissey is this stellar candidate against Manchin. I think Morrissey is a terrible candidate. I think he has glaring vulnerabilities. The guy is a longtime lobbyist. Not only that, his wife is a lobbyist. He's a terrible candidate. But here's the problem. Like, and I also think that Manchin is a gifted politician. He is exceptionally good at it. He's very well connected to his state. There's a million reasons why he should win, except that West Virginia is almost completely radicalized these days. The forces at work there are so strong, they would drag down almost any Democrat. In fact, we wouldn't even be talking about the issue of West Virginia if it wasn't for Manchin. He's the only one reason we're having a conversation that it's still competitive. But having said that, like, it is so tough for a Democrat to win statewide in West Virginia these days.
Sheer reputation and force of personality on Joe Manchin's part.
But there's so much going on there. Think about all the social, cultural, and economic change there. They lost two longstanding, well-respected political leaders that governed the state for decades. Whether you're talking about Robert Byrd or Jay Rockefeller. You've got the opioid crisis. You had 8 years of that state, whether fairly or not, that state believed that the federal government, as led by the president, was engaging in a war on their state. Many people believe that, and it has had a powerful influence through West Virginia, and Manchin is living with that.
Charlie, you mentioned that you thought overall it was a good day for the establishment, but one surprising anti-establishment result that really jumped out at us on Tuesday night was Congressman Robert Pittenger, the Republican from North Carolina's 9th District, lost his primary. It was a repeat challenge. He had won against the same challenger, Reverend Mark Harris, by a little over 100 votes in 2016. He was expected to dispatch Harris more easily this time. Instead, he lost by a handful of points. And meanwhile, Democrats are going hard after that district as well. And that's going to be a really tough battleground in the fall. But a bit of a surprise for our first member of Congress to go down and lose a seat in 2018.
And I will say that Nerdcast listeners were the first to hear about the Pittenger race. Last week we talked about that being one of the races to watch. I mean, I think that's just an outlier. It's an anomaly. Pittenger, you know, he knew he was going to get a tough primary challenge, and maybe he didn't, you know, gear up enough for it. Maybe his constituent services weren't good enough. Clearly, he had an opponent that had some game who nearly knocked him off 2 years earlier, had some real grassroots presence. In any case, in the final analysis, this only makes it harder for Republicans to hold that seat because I think that Harris is not nearly as strong as Pittenger in a general election environment.
And, you know, that's one of a handful of seats in both Ohio and North Carolina where they had the primaries the other night, where you've got, like, Trump winning 52, 53, 54, 55% of the vote. You know, it's a Republican-leaning district, but not the most overwhelming Republican district you could have, because when Republicans drew those maps at the beginning of the decade, they wanted to kind of spread themselves over as many districts as possible to try and maximize their gains. But what that means now with the environment a little worse, you know, Democratic enthusiasm is threatening to kind of tip over the top of that levee a little bit in some of those districts. And Pittenger's is a big example of it.
Right. But and my point about the it was a decent night for the establishment was it was a decent night for incumbents, despite, you know, I know a lot of people don't think it was, because Rokita and Messer lost in Indiana and Pittenger lost. But if you look at the bulk of the, you know, 40 some House races or incumbents who were on the ballot, many of them were unopposed and won their nominations because they had no challengers. Many of them won by 80% in their primary, so the bulk of them won pretty easily. And so we're not seeing signs of this inchoate rage out there at all politicians. If there's rage, it's directed pretty narrowly toward Republicans, and you don't see it broadly, as in one of those years where voters want to throw everyone out.
Well, and we saw, right, the Ohio gubernatorial primary, we saw Attorney General Mike DeWine, who's been in office forever, win the Republican nomination. We saw Richard Cordray, the former Attorney General, and the Elizabeth Warren protege, who was the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau head. He won the Democratic primary very easily over Dennis Kucinich. So, you know, that would be yet more evidence of that, right, Steve? Kind of there's still plenty of people who don't want to, you know, throw the bums out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Mike DeWine's been in office for nearly 40 years. Richard Cordray represented the establishment choice for governor there. I'm interested to see how that race plays out. That's a rematch of the 2010 attorney general race when DeWine unseated Cordray and led to Cordray coming to Washington in the first place. I want to go back to one point that you made about these maps in Ohio and North Carolina that were drawn by Republicans after the 2010 census. I feel like we have this conversation at the end of every decade about these congressional maps that are drawn at the start of the decade that play entirely differently when the decade comes to a close. And this is the second to last election that'll be held under these maps.
That's a great point.
It's not just that the political environment changes on a national level. Population patterns change in all of these states during the decade between the redistricting processes. And we see so many times these political parties get greedy early in the decade and pat themselves on the back, only to find things turn against them. And we saw this happen in Illinois, didn't we, 10 years ago?
Yeah, I think Steve's right on the money. And you know who the most perfect example of that is? Newt Gingrich. Because in the 90s, Georgia Democrats hated his guts. This is, he's starting to rise. I think it was probably before he is elected as speaker, but Democrats can't stand him. And Georgia Democrats in the legislature draw a map expressly designed to end his career. What happened next was history. They weren't able to knock him out. And you know another person who Pennsylvania Democrats tried to knock out in the 1990s, Rick Santorum. They drew an absolutely unwinnable district in the Mon Valley because, again, they couldn't stand him in the state capitol when he was a young congressman. They drew an unwinnable district that was like a 70% performing Democratic district. And Santorum went out and won that district, and that's what started his career. Or actually, I mean, that's what kept his career going
and
as
allowed
a young
him
politician.
Yeah, to win election to the Senate later.
Yep.
All right. So that's our roundup from last week, but we're in this big stretch of multi-state primary days coming up. So we've got stuff coming up on next Tuesday as well, the 15th. We've got primaries in Idaho, Nebraska, Oregon, and the big one, Pennsylvania. Coming up, four states. We've got a couple governor's races. We've got a lot of battleground House primaries out there. What are each of you looking forward to in those states? You know, Steve, what's a big one that we should be keeping an eye out for?
Well, the big one is Pennsylvania, but I'm going to let Charlie talk about that. I wouldn't dare to step on Charlie's Pennsylvania cred. So if you want Pennsylvania talk, just wait 30 seconds. For me, it's a small state, but Idaho governor. Congressman Raul Labrador has carved a huge profile here in D.C. as one of the leaders of the Freedom Caucus, one of the most conservative members of the House. He's tried to use his leverage on a lot of the big legislative fights where the Freedom Caucus has weighed in, oftentimes against House leadership. And now he's trying to leave Washington and run for governor, but his path to that nomination is far from assured, even though he represents roughly half of the state's population already. He's locked in a tight three-way primary there, and you know, it's Idaho. There's not a lot of public polling. The campaigns aren't necessarily talking about their internals, so we don't. But by all accounts, he doesn't have that on lockdown by any stretch of the imagination. And so, you know, for someone who's built a big profile here in Washington, he could find his political career stymied if he doesn't come out on top on next Tuesday.
That's really interesting. Charlie?
Yeah, well, I mean, I know you guys are a little insecure about, you know, how New York compares to Pennsylvania and how we have so many world championship teams in the eastern part of the state, Philadelphia.
How'd the Sixers look last night, Charlie?
Yeah, but you know what? The Penguins won the Stanley Cup last year. I don't even like Pittsburgh. Eagles are the, you know, Super Bowl champions. Either way, I won't go on and on about Pennsylvania, in part because it's so confusing right now. It's just a mess with the new congressional districts. It's really hard to say, you know, what the new politics of the state are going to look like, other than delegation's not going to be that Republican. To me, the big race, we really... You know, I'm curious to see just from the primary results what it looks like in the Trump era, what maybe shows up in the county results. I want to see what the implications are for, even though, again, there's lots of interesting House races, House primaries there, but it's so crowded and messy, it's really hard to draw any lessons. I mainly want to know, what does it all mean for the Casey Barletta Senate race in the fall, which really doesn't show many signs of life right now. To me, what I'm really looking forward to is, and I know this is off script, but, you know, I'm looking down the road to June 5th, which is, you know, sort of that big burst of primaries, including California.
So big primary night, again, to keep an eye out for coming up this Tuesday, Pennsylvania and three other states. We're going to have live coverage on Politico.com as usual. Hope you tune in. Steve, thank you so much for joining to talk us through that.
You got it.
All right, let's move on to our next data point today, which is three. North Korea released three American detainees this week as Kim Jong-un prepares to hold a historic summit with President Donald Trump. And here to break this and Trump's Iran deal exit down for us, which it seems really difficult to separate them as we think about this president and his presidency and what he's doing on foreign policy. Here to break it all down, we have Politico's foreign affairs correspondent, Nahal Tusi.
Hey there.
Thank you so much for joining us. And White House reporter and Nerdcast regular, Nancy Cook.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start with North Korea. Holly, take us inside what's happening here and Kim Jong-un's transformation in President Trump's eyes from a madman, his words, along with a lot of other insults, to a, quote, honorable potential partner in negotiations over world peace, as the president put it on Twitter this morning.
That's right. Listen, this is a lot of theater, but frankly, not much substance yet. What we have is a dictator in North Korea who has a nuclear weapons program now. He knows he has this weapons program, and he wants to raise his standing on the world stage. And one way to do that is to have a meeting with the president of the United States. Meanwhile, we have a president of the United States who loves theater and loves drama and wants happily to be the first guy to meet with the first president, I should say, to meet with this North Korean leader. And overall, though, does it mean we're going to have a denuclearized Korean peninsula? We don't know yet. The two sides don't even have the same definition of denuclearization. So if this summit even
happens...
Actually,
wait, can I interrupt you there? Because that's fascinating. Like, what is the difference in the two sides' definitions of denuclearization?
Well, when the North Koreans say denuclearize the peninsula, that means they don't want the South Koreans to have any sort of access to nuclear weapons. And South Korea is under the U.S.'s nuclear umbrella. And so when they look at it, they think, you know, a denuclearized Korean peninsula means that we don't want any U.S. troops in South Korea. They have a much grander view. For the U.S., it's about making sure that the North Koreans have no nuclear weapons program whatsoever. And that's, you know, getting from one thing to the other, there's a lot of room in between. But again, if this summit happens, it will be historic. I am increasingly betting that it is going to happen. Is it going to lead to anything that's like a long-term solution? I would not put money on that yet.
Nancy, meanwhile, this is taking up, it seems like, an increasing amount of time and profile in the White House as opposed to domestic politics and policy, right? And we saw, obviously, the president up in the middle of the night last night welcoming these people home from North Korea, where they've been in detention for a long time, and a bit of grand stagecraft. But this is kind of the main thing right now for the White House, it seems like.
Absolutely. I have a story that's coming out that talks about this. But the people that I talked to inside the White House basically said, like, the North Korea summit is the front burner main issue for the president. It's what he's obsessed with. It's what he's focused on. He sees this a couple different ways. He sees this as a way to sort of have a great headline for the White House. He also sees it, you know, he really views things in terms of like opposition and enemies. And so he always wants to do things that, like, you know, other people weren't able to do. So he sees this as a chance to have this historic, serious moment, become a serious president, and sort of deal with North Korea in a way that Bush, Obama, and Clinton were not able to do. And that's really driving him.
Yeah. And you know, but it also means that there's going to be a lot riding on what exactly is discussed during this particular meeting. So if President Trump decides to only discuss A, B, and C with Kim Jong-un if and when they meet face-to-face, then the Koreans might walk away thinking, the president of the United States only cares about A, B, and C, not D, not E, not F. And so you have a number of people trying to make sure that what they care about is put on the agenda. I recently wrote a piece about how human rights organizations really want Trump to make it very clear that he wants North Korea to improve its human rights record. And they want him to talk about it because if they feel like if he doesn't do that at this meeting, then it might just never come up again.
It's off the table forever.
Or that the Koreans might walk away.
He's going to do that, do they? I mean, he shows no interest whatsoever in human rights.
Except for a handful of countries that the U.S. views as adversaries. He cares about human rights in Iran. He cares about human rights in North Korea. He cares about human rights in Venezuela, or at least he says he does. He has used human rights as a cudgel against these countries, but he's ignored human rights in countries that he views as allies, like Egypt, like Saudi Arabia, et cetera. It's a very selective use of human rights, and human rights organizations say that it exposes American hypocrisy.
Well, I've talked to, you know, and just in terms of like how much Trump cares about the summit and sort of the risks and rewards of it, I've talked to, you know, different foreign policy and national security experts in the last 24 hours. And some of them say, even people who are critical of Trump say, you know, his showmanship can be put to good use here because he is, you know, building momentum and sort of, you know, sort of building a warm relationship with North Korea, sort of setting the stage for potentially good talks. The people I talk to, though, are very fearful that the president, because in past policy debates has not cared about details, and we've seen this with pulling out of TPP, pulling out of the Iran deal, healthcare, tax reform, he just doesn't care about the details. They're worried that he'll go into the talks and, as Halle said, sort of walk away and be like, we have a deal, whereas what national security experts want to see happen is he's sort of the showman. He goes in, you know, he has a meeting and then really leaves like the technical negotiations to national security experts and advisors. And they're worried that he'll skip that second step and that the U.S. will somehow get fleeced.
Meanwhile, as all this is happening with North Korea, as the United States is engaging more with North Korea, it's disengaging with Iran, right? We saw President Trump give a televised national address earlier this week in which he announced that he's going to be pulling the United States out of the multilateral Iran deal to prevent that was negotiated in 2015 to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons. Holly?
Well, look, Trump said that Iran is not abiding by the deal, and that, you know, he's worried about Iran's activities beyond the deal. You know, when you look at what he wants, it's as if he wants the U.S. and other world powers, or at least the U.S., to strike a deal with Iran that covers every bad thing Iran has ever done and every bad thing that Iran will ever do forever and ever. And this is the type of thing, it's like a grand bargain, if you want to call it, that experts, others, officials, you know, they say this is just not feasible.
Is it fair to say, like, looking at the Iran deal from 2015, that essentially that President Obama and the United States and other countries at that point said, it's like, okay, like, we know that Iran is a bad actor and that some of this stuff is going to continue, but we are willing to put that aside in order to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon, basically.
Well, look, they didn't say we're going to put that aside. They simply said we're going to deal with those other things in other ways, but let's make sure to get this nuclear deal so that those other things that they're doing it without nuclear weapons. And you got to remember, like, if you want to strike a deal, the other side has to be willing to agree to the deal. And Iranians were only willing to talk about the nuclear issue and nothing more as part of this agreement. And so Trump is betting that here's what's happening. Here's the connection. He thinks he has seen his international pressure campaign on North Korea seemed to pay off, right? He's put a lot of international pressure, bringing other countries and stuff, increasing sanctions, et cetera, on North Korea. And now the North Koreans are coming to the table. And so he thinks, I can do this again with Iran. Screw this deal that Obama negotiated, and he doesn't like anything Obama did. I'm going to start from scratch. I'm going to build a global coalition, and we're going to make Iran come to the table again. And we're going to strike a major deal that deals with any bad thing that they ever do. I don't know how much time you guys to have, but I mean, he's going to need at least another term to get this done.
And I also just want to point out, like, this is happening against the backdrop, and he's really turned to foreign policy and trying to make sort of big historic deals against the backdrop of, you know, major sort of ongoing daily negative headlines about either the Mueller investigation, you know, Michael Cohen and his lawyer. There have been explosive stories this week about how, you know, Russian oligarchs and then also U.S. companies were basically like funneling money to Michael Cohen, you know, after Trump was elected, sort of looking for some insight into the Trump administration. So there's just like this daily barrage of headlines about all these investigations. And interestingly, you know, Trump, a bit like Nixon, has turned to foreign policy to try to sort of score some big wins ahead of the midterms. And I think that there's a sense in the White House, like, you know, if you can, you know, they got tax reform, they're remaking the judiciary. If they can have these sort of big historic foreign policy wins, even if some of the details may not end up being as winning as perhaps they say they are, that will really say to the American public, like, forget all these other things. Look at our record.
Remind me, guys, is Infrastructure Week over yet?
Oh, yeah, that's let's hope that every time there's an Infrastructure Week, it's like the craziest news week ever.
I love a good infrastructure joke. That lightens the mood there as we talk about like nuclear.
Look, foreign nuclear policy arms. It's like Nancy said, foreign policy is like the favorite refuge of a beleaguered president. And Trump is turning to it. And he knows that a lot of people are just going to focus on that first headline of him shaking Kim's hand. And they're not going to follow it up. I mean, these things take years to really play out.
Well, and also, like, foreign policy is a good refuge, too, because, you know, Congress, the margins in the Senate with McCain out and being sick are tiny. You really can't get anything through Congress at this point in a midterm election year. And so, like, if you're going to get stuff done, it has to be much more on the world stage. And you know, Trump is taking advantage of it. He met the detainees, you know, on the tarmac at 3 a.m. with a bunch of TV cameras and an American flag behind him. You know, he's going to make the most of this opportunity visually.
But is he really how interested is he in the details of foreign policy? I mean, I don't want to be too much of a cynic, but to me, he's embracing this opportunity solely because of the optics and the theater of it. I mean, he's a guy who we know does not care. He doesn't care about briefing books. He doesn't care about the details of policy. He's not an ideologue. He cares a great deal about the optics of everything. And so he shows up at Andrews Air Force Base at 3 a.m. just to greet the prisoners because he knows it's a great visual.
People in the White House, so critics would say, like, he doesn't – I think everyone agrees he doesn't care about the details. Critics would say that's a problem. You know, presidents have to have some grounding in the substance. People in the White House would tell you, as they've told me, you know what? He's a leader. You know, he's empowering his cabinet in a way that Obama didn't. You know, other people can work out the details. This is his governing style. And I had, you know, one Republican yesterday tell me, you know, Reagan didn't care about the details either. Reagan, when he was asked about the Cold War, said, "We win, they lose. That's my policy on the Cold War." And that was, you know, his message. And I think Trump is trying to replicate some of that historically.
So, Holly, you mentioned the importance of that kind of initial headline, that kind of initial image, and we've all talked about it for a few minutes. So what should we, you know, I'll give you the last word here. What should we be looking out for then beyond that? What kind of guideposts or milestones should we be looking out for on Iran, on North Korea going forward to get a sense and gauge whether either of these approaches is working.
Well, on the Iran front, I would watch what Europe decides to do in terms of responding to U.S. sanctions, which in many cases would affect European businesses. I would watch what Iran is doing right now in Syrian territory. I mean, it looks like we're on the verge of a huge conflict between Iran and Israel. And on the North Korea front, frankly, I would just watch to see if there's more meetings planned after Kim and Trump meet and who is going to be in those meetings and what policies they're going to be discussing in those meetings. And then I would watch to see if those meetings actually happen.
Okay. All right. That's a good checklist for all of us. Thank you so much for joining us and walking us through some pretty complicated territory.
It's great to be here.
Nancy, thank you for joining us as usual.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Charlie, thank you.
I have to say, correct my Pittsburgh comment earlier. I actually like Pittsburgh. Seriously, no. I mean, it's a great place to go. I went there over the weekend for a weekend with my family. It's just wonderful. It's delightful. Lovely
place. I've
heard
place. It's really nice.
Yeah, and Promontis is fantastic. I mean, it obviously is second city to Philadelphia, but it's a beautiful city.
Just do you care about Pittsburgh more than you care about Paris?
No, it's just I said something mean about Pittsburgh and I didn't really mean it.
All right, one last big thank you to all of our guests today. And as promised, we're going to turn things over briefly to a Nerdcast superfan to take us through the credits. Michael Pfau in Minneapolis. Take it away.
Nerdcast is produced by Bridget Mulcahy and Micaela Rodriguez, with help this week from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer. Nerdcast's researcher is Zach Montalaro, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Michael. Listeners, we found Michael because he emailed in to say that he was a fan. If you are a fan of the Nerdcast who wants to read the credits, let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you again next week.